I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Chances are you overindulged during the holidays, enjoying parties, helping yourself to seconds, having one too many drinks. I know I did. It's one of the pleasures and the hazards of the season, and it's what inspires New Year's resolutions to eat right and get more active. So today on Radio Times, the latest in diet, health, and fitness. Later in the hour, we'll be checking in on the effectiveness and accuracy of exercise trackers that have grown so popular, and the many reasons that nuts are a healthy snack. But joining us here in our Philadelphia studios, and she'll be staying with us for the full hour, is Stella Volpe. She's professor and chair of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University. She is a nutritionist and an exercise physiologist. And Stella Volpe, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be back, Marty.
So do you feel like a slug as I do?
I try to keep up my exercise during the holidays.
But is it January rolls around and everyone feels like they're just carrying some extra poundage from, 6 weeks of indulgence?
Yes, and actually research has shown some people can gain about 10 pounds over the holidays, right? Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, people really do go to parties, eat a lot more, indulge more, and sometimes those 10 pounds are very difficult to lose.
Well, especially in the winter when you don't feel like being quite as active when the weather's nicer. Does weather impact how active people are?
Weather really impacts how people are. And in days like what we've been having, the minus, 2 degrees, et cetera, there's also the safety issue, as far as how, if it's too cold and frostbite, et cetera. And so weather definitely impacts it. People would rather be in cozy,
yes,
with hot chocolate,
yes,
next to a fire. I think we all want to do that. But there are things we can do inside the house as well. When the weather is inclement and people either it's too dangerous, they can do things inside as well as, when it gets better to go outside.
So what should we be doing inside while we're in front of the fire watching TV or doing all those slothful things?
So if someone is in front of the TV, for example, there are very, very easy things and you don't need any pieces of equipment. You can do things like air squats, for example, which are just squatting up and down. You can do sit-ups. You can even do push-ups if you're able to do that. Now, mind you, me giving you the recommendations are very generalized,
right,
depending on how fit someone is. But people need to start off with something. And my motto to people always is better than nothing. Something is always better than nothing. Because, as Americans, we want to be marathoners in one day.
And get it all done in one day, right?
Exactly. And think that we can do that all in one day if we haven't been exercising for 6 months or several years. So what I always tell people is if you have 5 minutes, give yourself 5 minutes. If you're building up with exercise and tell yourself, okay, I'm going to do this for 5 minutes. It doesn't have to be difficult. It can be very simple, but it's getting you moving.
And that's the important thing is to move.
It is. The important thing is to move and get that first step, literally and figuratively.
Because I think for a lot of people, it's TV and snacks. I mean, the sort of combo of sedentary life.
It's true, right? Most of us, we want to watch something on TV. We like to watch something. And what do? We go and get some snacks. And we get a lot more snacks than probably we quote-unquote should. And the snacks we typically choose are the not good for us snacks. So what I'll often tell people as well is during commercials, why not dance? Why not go up and down the stairs in your house if you have stairs? March in place. Play with your children. Play hide-and-go-seek if you have children, or so that it gets you moving. So you don't need to watch the commercials. So you can go and get moving during those commercials.
Is there a certain level of activity you think that people should aim for? I mean, is 5 minutes enough? Obviously, more is better. But is there a certain threshold?
There is a certain threshold. We really should try to shoot for about 30 to 60 minutes per day, depending on the intensity. So the more intense the activity, actually, the less time you need to spend because you're burning more calories. But the less intense, you want to try to build to that. But the reason I say people should start with five,
right,
is because they often think five is nothing. So I even often tell my mother-in-law that. I said, just go on the treadmill for 5 minutes. Give yourself 5 minutes. She loves to exercise, but she's back problems. So people who have problems, I'll tell them, do a few minutes at a time. Leave it, go back. You can do multiple bouts of exercise, which has been shown actually to be equally as effective as one long bout of exercise.
I have seen, in fact, some people that work here stand at their desk. Is that a smart thing? Is that a good thing to think about?
Excellent thing to think about. I actually have a balance ball at my desk. And so that, again, nothing, it's not like I'm exerting a lot of calories, but it makes me focus on my core. I sit up a little straighter. And sometimes you can even do some sit-ups, you know, or you can bounce up and down a little bit, something that you can't do on the regular chairs.
So this is a ball?
It's
like a big...
Those big balance balls that you see, like in the gyms.
Yes.
And I just have one in my office. I have one at my home office, and it's just very nice to sit on. If people are going to try it, I do recommend that they don't start off with like a half an hour at one time, you know, so that they want to build up to it. But even if, again, watching TV, sitting on that watching TV could be at least one more added thing to that they're doing.
Because you're working on I guess not falling off the ball, right?
You are. You're working on that those core muscles.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to give out the phone number and get some folks in our conversation. That's Stella Volpe. She's professor chair of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. She is a nutritionist and exercise physiologist. We called her up because probably like many of you, we are feeling kind of fat these days, just ate and drank a bit too much over the holidays. So give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coame. Stella, you talked about that, you know, people gaining as much as 10 pounds over the holiday. Are there any sort of magic solutions to losing that weight?
You know, people like to hear that there are magic solutions. Unfortunately, they're not. I mean, the down bottom line is energy expenditure has to be greater than that energy intake. So, but the one thing that I will usually tell people as well is, okay, so you've done that, and maybe even now we have some of the residuals. We keep sort of seeing some candies around. We still eat. But the idea is maybe stay away from them a little bit, or if you're going to have some, you know, the idea in general, even snacking in front of the television, if you're going to go get some chips, put them in a bowl. And therefore, if you eat it out of the bag, the human nature, we will eat the whole bag, likely, right? But if we put it in a bowl, even if you go back for seconds, Marty, you will likely eat a lot less than if you have the bag in front of you. Yes. So portion control is really one of the keys to decreasing body weight.
And we know that in this country, portions have just gotten bigger and bigger over, what, the last generation or two?
Yes, since probably the 1970s, some things have, even if you look at French fries from fast food restaurants, you know, the smalls increased, you know, like 20%, 30%, and then the large is like by 300%.
Wow.
Right, and so now we have these supersized things, supersized sodas that can pack in like 800 calories if they're regular sodas and people aren't thinking about it, especially when they're liquids. Most of us don't think of calories when they're liquids, right? So that's another thing to think about. Yes, you can indulge, but look at the size and be aware of the size. And I think sometimes if that's what people start with is, let's look at the size of what I'm eating, that makes them aware. And even if they don't change how they're eating, but they look at the portions, at least that's one start.
And calories, I mean, we should count calories?
Yes, I'm not a huge fan of counting calories, but I think people should be aware. If you're aware of portions being smaller, then the calories will come down.
And it seems more and more restaurants and even fast food restaurants are putting calories and some of the content in their food. Do people use that information wisely and incorporate that into their eating habits?
Well, I wish I could tell you they
you
did.
You have a look on your face. I have to say, Stella Volpe.
Well, you know, that some of that work was actually done at Drexel, you know, by, you know, Amy Auchincloss at Public Health and actually one of our faculty, Beth Lienberg. And, you know, they found that it impacted it some, but not as much as you think it would. So sometimes people, you know, look at the calories and say, oh, you know what, so what? There are some people who do pay attention, but the percentage is not as great as we would hope it would be.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you read it, you see a certain kind of a hamburger or something is 1,000 calories.
Yes. And doesn't that blow your mind?
Blows my mind.
Marty, I mean, I'm a nutritionist, and I look at that, and I think, oh, my gosh, I even don't think I would have calculated that. So sometimes when there's a drastic difference, people may go down to the lower one. If there's a drastic difference in calories, but yet they feel like they're still going to get the same taste. Right. But overall, people want to go for that taste if they're really craving something.
Well, that's why it's sugar and salt and fat, right?
Exactly.
All those tastes. Let me see what looks like Isaac from Cherry Hill has to say. And Isaac, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Hi, Isaac.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Thank you so much for this topic. It's been great while I drive. I had a quick question. I'm curious, in reality, how fast does your body get used to the same exercise? So, for example, I cycle to work every day. I also like to walk every day. But I hear people always saying you need to, you know, verify or to bring different exercises to your regime. How often does your body get used to that same exercise? And do we need to be concerned about that?
Isaac, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Does a body get used to a certain kind of exercise, Stella?
Yes, it does. Isaac, that's a great question. The getting used to depends on the length of time. Your body sort of becomes accustomed to it. However, one thing I will always tell people is you need to change things up. So, Isaac, even if you don't change what you're doing, changing the intensity, like even when you're cycling, if you can change the intensity, or when you're walking, maybe throw a little jogging in there, it's really important to do that. So I always tell people, you know, it's great if you get on that elliptical every day for 30 minutes. That's wonderful, and I wouldn't dare condemn it. But if you're doing that same thing every day, and especially a lot of my friends who are going through menopause and they're asking me, Stella, how come I'm not losing weight? I said, but because you're exercising, which is great, but you need to change things up.
Oh.
And higher intensity exercise can be very, very healthful and helpful to losing weight. The only negative thing, Marty, is you need to be careful, because if you're starting not fit, you definitely don't want to go into high intensity exercise right away.
And is it harder to lose weight once you've reached menopause, or is there weight gain associated with menopause?
There is weight gain associated with menopause because we're not producing estrogen anymore, and so therefore now the body's slowing down some. However, people can still keep their weight at bay if they, again, mix things up. And women in particular tend to be a little bit afraid to weight train. And weight training is not only excellent for our bones and muscles, but it burns more calories. So people need to be aware of that.
And when you say weight training?
Weight training can be with weights. It can be with TheraBands, you know, those bands that you can get. But some type of resistance. You can even use your own body weight. You know, push-ups, pull-ups, those kinds of things are very, very helpful as well.
How much of a problem is boredom when it comes to, you know, and perhaps I'm revealing my own resistance to going to the gym, but how much of that is a problem, I guess, for staying fit and perhaps even losing weight?
That's a big thing. Okay, so if we think about it, 20% of people in the U.S. are about 20% exercise on a regular basis. So that's 80% of people who might be exercising here and there. So some of it is boredom. Some of it is the fact that people might not be able to afford a gym, but you don't have to go to a gym to be fit. But people's, you know, I think when people come, when it comes to push comes to shove, people would probably rather do less than more. You know,
yes.
As a society, we've become more efficient, haven't we? You know, remote controls. So I often tell people, even our sedentary behaviors have become more sedentary. You know, when I was younger, and probably when you were younger, we used to change that channel,
yeah,
didn't we?
Had by to get
hand.
Out of our chair.
Right, we did. And so that's something to think about. So boredom is a big thing, and that's why changing things up. And two things, if we can act more like children and like dogs, we'd have a lot more fun. If you ever notice children, we wouldn't want to put them on a treadmill, right? They run. They
don't
stop.
Need to.
They don't need to. Dogs, they run. They go sniff something. They sprint. They slow down. So if we could become more like that, we'd have a lot more fun.
Well, that does sound like fun. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about how to lose some of that winter weight, how to get more fit. And again, our guest is Stella Volpe, chair of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University. We have Richard Mattis waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about why we should be eating nuts. We do want to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
The Friends Schools of Bucks County are committed to challenging minds and nurturing spirits to prepare students for life. Providing independent education from preschool through 12th grade, the Friends Schools of Bucks County include United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School. Guided by Quaker values, these schools provide a core curriculum while fostering exploration, self-discipline, creativity, and a desire to learn. United Friends, Newtown Friends, Buckingham Friends, and the George School support WHYY.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you two tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, can paralyzing injuries in hockey be prevented by an orange warning line in front of the boards?
You're going to get caught with your head down, yet you don't know when you're going out of bounds, you're going to hit the boards until you actually hit the board.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Stella Volpe about how to get healthy, stay healthy, setting health goals for this year. And joining us now is Richard Mattis. He's Distinguished Professor of Nutrition Science in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. And Richard Mattis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Well, we called you up because we know that you have been doing some research on the consumption of nuts and even some of the health benefits of nuts. What kind of nuts are we talking about?
Well, most of our work has been limited to almonds and peanuts, but the literature would suggest that the different kinds of nuts are more similar than they are dissimilar.
And is the takeaway that we should be incorporating more nuts into our daily diet?
Well, I think the takeaway is that they can be included in the diet without posing a threat to weight gain and providing some desirable nutrients. But always it's an individual choice, and for some people it will work into their diet well. For others, they have to make their own choices.
So what are the good things that we should know about nuts?
Well, I guess arguing against some of the negative perceptions is the best place to start. They are high in fat. They are high energy-dense foods. And as a result, many people have thought that they are problematic for weight gain. And the literature is very, very clear that that is not the case now. You know, this started with early surveys, epidemiologic studies that surprisingly found that there was an inverse association between the frequency of nut consumption and body weight. That is, people that ate nuts more frequently actually weighed somewhat less than people who abstained. That was surprising to everybody, but it was followed up with clinical trials and short-term feeding trials that all supported that, that including the nuts in the diet didn't promote weight gain.
Now, let me stop you there, only because I'm interested in why you think that is, and I do want to get a response from Stella Volpe as well. Why do you think, if we're talking about something that's high in fat, energy dense, why isn't there weight gain?
Yeah, there are three mechanisms that seem to account for this. First, they're very satiating. That is, they make people feel full, and as a result, they spontaneously eat less at other times of the day and offset about two-thirds to three-quarters of the energy provided by the nuts. So that accounts for a large proportion of the energy. Second, we don't chew them very well. And as a result, many of the calories from the nuts are not what we call bioaccessible or absorbed by the body. They pass through us, and somewhere between 5% and 20% of the energy is just not available to us metabolically. And then the third contributor is that there are a few studies that suggest that with regular consumption, there's a slight increase in resting energy expenditure. So we're increasing energy output. We're not increasing energy input because we offset those calories by eating less at other times. As a result, we remain relatively neutral. Now, I don't want to suggest that you can eat them in any quantity with impunity, but in moderation, they don't seem to pose any risk for weight gain.
Does this make sense to you, Stella Volpe?
Makes a lot of sense.
Really?
Sense. Yes. Thanks, Richard. That was perfectly described.
And makes sense. Why?
Well, you know, in particular, the first mechanism that Richard stated was the fat. Fat of the three macronutrients, fat, carbohydrates, and protein, that makes us the most full, makes us feel most satiated. So when we feel more full, we'll tend to eat less. Compared to if you eat a whole lot of lettuce, say, with nothing with it. I mean, lettuce is great for us, don't get me wrong, but that these nuts now will help people maybe as a small snack. Usually we say like a 2 tablespoons maybe, and that might help them to offset having snacked a whole lot more otherwise.
Does that make sense to you?
I might,
yeah, go
I
ahead,
might add to this that... And I think that the fat is part of the story. But in studies where the different components of nuts have been isolated to see what really accounts for this satiety effect, it hasn't been possible to identify any one component. So I think it's a combination of the fat, of the protein, of the fiber, and the texture, the crunch. So whole nuts actually are more satiating than, say, butters. And there is something about the total package that's important there.
Something about the crunch, as you say, Richard Mattis.
Yeah.
What, we like to chew on things?
Well, actually, there's some evidence that just the mechanical act of chewing generates a satiety signal that activates certain neural mechanisms that lead to a sense of fullness. But it also has something to do with altering the physical form of the food, and as a result, the, as they say, bioaccessibility, or the ability of the individual to absorb the energy from them.
Well, because I'm trying to imagine, I'm looking at you, Stelavope, someone, you wouldn't want to eat a stick of butter, which also has a lot of fat, right? But certainly no crunch.
Exactly, no crunch. But also, the saturated fat part of butter is also something, again, that's, not heart healthy, whereas nuts also provide us with this good fat called omega-3s. And so they have a lot more a lot more omega-3 fatty acids, which are heart healthy.
So the idea we should, if we're not eating nuts, we should think about maybe a couple tablespoons a day?
Yes, I think that would be actually a very good thing if people aren't allergic, obviously, and if they like nuts, it would be a good thing to incorporate. And perhaps, based on Richard's work and others' work, for them to maybe try that out as a snack to see if it also helps with their weight control and their intake.
So Stella actually raises a critical point. It's my opinion that snacking or more frequent eating is often problematic for people in terms of weight gain. We talk about eating multiple small meals of the day, and if people really did that, that would probably have desirable health consequences. Unfortunately, most people don't reduce the size of their eating events adequately to offset the increased frequency. As a result, it can lead to positive energy balance. So snacking is, in my mind, a real contributor to weight gain. And the beauty of nuts is that they seem to be particularly effective at moderating energy intake when used as a snack.
As I was reading some of your research at Richard Mattis, I was thinking about this increase in nut allergies that we have in this country. And I don't know whether you've looked at that, or I don't want to go off on a different tangent here, but I'm just curious about how you understand that phenomenon.
Yeah, well, that really is outside my area of expertise. It is an important issue. There's a lot of research being undertaken now to address it. Whether or not there is really an increase or just better detection now, better awareness, is still an open question. There aren't solutions for it yet, so people have to be careful.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you. And Richard, I'd love to have you stay for another 10 minutes or so. We've got some callers that want to join our conversation. Talking with Richard Mattis, Distinguished Professor of Nutrition Science in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. He and his colleagues have been looking at the benefits of eating nuts. Stella Volpe is Professor Chair of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. She is a exercise physiologist and a nutritionist. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coame. Let me get, looks like April from Williamstown, New Jersey. April, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to thank both of the speakers that you have on today for sharing this information.
Sure.
And I just wanted to share something that has really motivated me. Surprisingly, people are, feel different ways about social media, but Instagram has been absolutely amazing in terms of helping with my fit journey. I played basketball all my life, I went to college, played basketball in college, and in my adult life I have 10 children, but I've always worked, and I've always
worked out between
children. Yeah, but I was never a stay-at-home mom, believe it or not, until now. And so I had this idea that when I was a stay-at-home mom, it would be awesome. I'd work out. I'd have all the time in the world to do, you know, to be just in amazing shape. And it did work that way.
Well,
I found myself on Facebook and wasting time doing this and doing that. And then I finally made a decision that I was going to cut all that off. But I did stumble across Instagram. And the people on there who share their fitness journeys, the reason they're so motivational is because you see their journey in real time. You see their struggles, their down days. You know what it's like when it's raining and they don't want to go to the gym. It just makes it real.
Well, you know what, April, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I'm going to toss it first to you, Stella Volpe, which is, you know, being part, feeling that you're part of a group. I'm assuming that that's a helpful thing to have.
Feeling like you're part of a group is actually a big thing. For example, to exercise. Marty, if you and I wanted to go walking in the morning and met at 6 a.m. and one of us didn't show up, I don't think our friendship would last very long, right? So when you have the buddy system, that's really important. And Instagram and social media is a good way, but I'd also need to caution a little bit because there are many things that are put on there that are not correct, you know?
Oh.
I often will joke with my niece when she shows me something on Instagram about nutrition, and I said, oh, really? Because I didn't realize that that was true. So people need to be careful. You know, we use the internet as if it's all the gospel truth, and we have to be really careful with that. So, yes, buddy system, wonderful. A support system, excellent. I've shown that, and our research has shown that when people aren't with others, they don't exercise as much. Very, very good thing.
You want to add to that, Richard Mattis?
No, I think Stella's comments are spot on.
We had an email from Tom. I'll put this to you, Richard. Tom from Winona had some health problems. I'm not exactly sure what they are, but wanted to know about a healthy way of gaining weight. Are there ways to sort of think about gaining weight smartly and safely?
Sure. The simple answer is to eat more energy than you're expending, of course. But the trick is to do it by eating wholesome foods and not just empty calories. Even though it's no more exciting than a bag of nails, my advice is balance, moderation, and variety.
And I'm assuming
just
gaining
in slightly greater quantity.
I got you. But the idea, I mean, of doing it, I'm assuming you're saying doing it slowly and over time.
Sure.
Right. Anything you want to add to that, Stella?
No, I agree with Richard. The one thing, the slowly over time, too, is important because you don't want to gain fat mass. You know, so exercise, even though weight gain is an issue, exercise is still important at that with doing, you know, increasing your weight.
Let me see what, I think we have Julie next. Julie calling us from Schwenksville. And Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. You're on the air. No, we don't have Julie. She wanted to know if there was a link between caffeine and losing weight. Is
hi.
There? Oh, Julie, is that you?
Yes, hi.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
I wanted to know if I eat very well. I eat a lot of wild salmon. I eat plenty of nuts and seeds and make my own healthy meals, granolas and vegetarian chili. I eat very well. I'm about 58, and I do drink a lot of caffeine, not coffee, but tea. I can't seem, I'm in a plateau here with my weight. 5'7", maybe 149, 150. I'd like to maybe lose another 12 or 13 pounds. I can't seem, I exercise every day, walking. I just joined the gym again. I can't seem to jumpstart these extra pounds I want to lose. Any ideas, or I thought maybe the caffeine, if I cut that out, or what would you suggest?
Julie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Does caffeine play a role in weight loss or weight gain, Julie?
Excuse me, Stella. Caffeine actually can play a role in weight loss, but really just early on. It's very minimal. And once we become, you know, include caffeine, normally the body becomes accustomed to it. So really there is no change. So tea is actually great for antioxidants. Unless she's overdoing it, I would say that there's no real need to cut it out. But sleep, getting enough sleep is very important that we often forget about. And Julie, the one thing I would suggest is what I suggested earlier, is maybe change up what you're doing in the gym. You know, again, maybe going on one machine for a few minutes, the next one for a few, and doing a little higher intensity workouts and mixing it up a little bit more and add some weight training and perhaps work with a personal trainer if you're not used to doing it prior to starting.
Richard, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. Actually, I would add one thing. There are a couple of papers just recently coming out that suggest that caffeine may actually provide some reward value to drinking, and as a result promotes greater consumption. I don't know if you add sweetener or an energy source to your tea, but if you drink a fair amount of it, those calories will add to the total diet. There's also evidence that drinking alone just begets eating. We tend to do the two in concert. And so if you think that your drinking leads you to snack more or whatever, that's something to watch.
Richard, as I was reading your some of your work, and it's fascinating, I was also wondering whether in 2 years' time we're going to read some studies or some reports basically saying, oops, no, nuts, not good for you. You know, now we have to take a look at something else. And I think it's just, you know, you see a headline, you read some stories, you think, oh, okay, you know, now I've found the perfect snack.
Yeah. Well, in nutrition, we do have a bit of a history of that. However, in this instance, there really is a substantial body of science, and it's uniquely consistent. Very few issues in nutrition do you find all scientists pretty much in agreement. There's usually at least two, if not more, camps that disagree with each other, and that's just not true in the case of nuts and energy balance. The literature is strikingly consistent, so it gives me confidence that we actually have stumbled onto something that we can rely on.
So throw out the chips, get rid of the chips, and substitute nuts?
Well, I am also sufficiently old school to say anything can fit. It's just in appropriate frequency and portion size. So I don't think one has to exclude any food, but if one has to make a choice between one or the other, a more nutritious choice is probably your better one.
So look, should we come up with a different word besides the word diet? And have you come up with one?
I wish I have come up with one, but I try not to use the word diet. I try to use the word healthful eating, or just even eating, you know, because people think of diet and they do think of some type of regimented eating program, and they think of some fad diet. And, you know, I really appreciate what Richard said, because I'm old school with that. We constantly say moderation and variety and, you know, better choices and healthier choices. But sometimes I will tell people, you know, 20% of the time, 80% of the time, eat as well as you can. 20% of the time, you know, let that be that chocolate, or have those, you know, little snacks you like, because when you include those in your diet, you're less likely to overindulge in them at another time.
Feeling so deprived, right?
Exactly.
Richard, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. We have a lot of experience that restriction leads to adverse dietary behavior. That learning to incorporate things intelligently is the better approach.
Well, on that note, Richard Mattis, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. And he's Distinguished Professor of Nutrition Science in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. And we called him up because he's been doing some interesting research on nuts and why nuts are good for us. Stella Volpe staying with us for the rest of the hour. And we've got another guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about those very popular exercise trackers. Do they work? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the music of Tchaikovsky, the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The January Tchaikovsky Festival begins as Stephen Huff performs the first piano concerto and Robin Tacciani conducts the fourth symphony. Tchaikovsky tickets at 215-893-1999 or online at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, the music of Tchaikovsky with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
On the next Fresh Air, a personal, medical, and pharmaceutical history of anxiety. We talk with Scott Stossel about his new book, My Age of Anxiety. Stossel has always suffered from many anxieties and phobias, and says he wrote the book to help him understand and find relief from or redemption in anxious suffering. Stossel is the editor of The Atlantic Magazine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Did you ever notice that your memory of an event can change depending on whom you're with? Do you find yourself negotiating the details of a memory with friends or family? On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, we hear from science writer Charles Fernyhough. His book, Pieces of Light, explains how autobiographical memory works. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Stella Volpe from Drexel University about the latest in health, fitness, and diet, how to get back into shape after those very slothful and glutton-filled weeks between Thanksgiving and New Year's. And joining us now is Nate Mekas, and he's Assistant Professor of Applied Exercise Science at Azusa Pacific University. And Nate Mekas, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me this morning, Marty.
You're very welcome. And I know you have been doing some very interesting research looking into these exercise trackers, a very popular item. I think a lot of people got them for Christmas and Hanukkah over the holidays. Why are you looking into these trackers?
You know, it's kind of a funny story. We actually, when I was doing some research, got a new tracker in, and I had actually thrown it on for a set of meetings I was in, just because I was curious to see how does it measure, what does it do. And I had been sitting down all day, and so I was kind of pacing back and forth slowly throughout this entire meeting. And when I got done, I analyzed the data, and it said I had been sitting still the entire time. Uh-huh. And I thought to myself, well, that's funny, because I'm pretty sure I was moving the entire time I was in this meeting. And so that kind of drove me to think, you know, how accurate are some of these trackers? Do they measure the things that we're actually doing, or is there something else that they're looking into? And so I started studying how do these things differ? And, you know, if we're going to be wearing these and trying to figure out does working in a kitchen count as exercise, we should be making sure we're measuring all these things accurately.
And broadly speaking, and there are a lot of name brands, and I'm not here to promote one over the other, but broadly speaking, let's say you're counting steps, something like that. Are they sort of relatively effective and accurate?
They are going to be across the spectrum. I have had pedometers and worn a couple different ones at a couple different times just to kind of compare, where some of them, you know, they'll count pretty accurately. They'll be within a few hundred steps for the day, whereas the ones you may get out of a cereal box sometimes tend to be within like 4,000 to 5,000 steps of accuracy, which is a huge, huge window, and that's not necessarily what we're looking for. So quality does actually matter quite a bit. But at the same time, you can get a very good piece of information from a relatively inexpensive tracker.
So let me get you back in on the conversation as an exercise physiologist. And obviously these trackers are designed to give people feedback about their activity level. Have you found or do you think it helps people stay more active if they know how many steps they've taken during the day?
Yes, research has shown that,
Yeah, hold on, Nate. And I want to just toss that first to Stella, and then I want to toss that to you as well.
You know, a lot of times when we give people feedback, it does help them. You know, but if I were to give you a pedometer, for example, you know, I would tell you for a week, just see where you are. Don't try to go to 10,000 steps. See where you are first. Let's get the average. And I'm not talking about quality right. of the pedometer, as Nate did. But then let's try to increase that, maybe by 1,000 steps per day, every day for the next couple weeks, and then up it after that. So what I like to do is provide it as feedback. And sometimes for kids in schools, it can be also added to like math, and they can track each other. I mean, graph the changes that they do. And adults can do the same and put it on the refrigerator to see how much better they're doing.
What have you found, Nate?
That's definitely one of the things that we've noticed. Whenever we give someone a tracker for the first time for a study, the first week they tend to be more active just because they're aware that, oh, somebody's actually monitoring what I'm doing. So I need to make sure that I'm meeting some sort of standard that they have in their own mind. So we see more realistic, normal performances after about a week of tracking. So generally we'll say, you know, let's give you a warm-up period, and then after that we'll see more what your normal activity is. We've tried a lot of different things, and you know, different people are wired different ways. I myself am very competitive. When I have a benchmark that someone else has set, I usually want to try to beat it. So if I have a friend who says, oh, you know, I've got 13,000 steps today, I may be trying for 13,500.
You're just that kind of a guy.
I'm just that kind of a guy.
Right there with you, Nat. Nate, rather.
But I mean, it seems like more trackers are giving more information. You can, you know, the quality of your sleep, how many calories you're consuming, and your heart rate, and all that kind of stuff. Are these feedback devices, Nate? Are they generally good? Do they help people change and maintain more healthy behavior? Do we know that?
You know, we don't know the answer to that question yet. We're seeing that all this information can be very beneficial. And part of what I usually tell people when looking at different sort of fitness tracker devices, it's important to understand what you're going to do. Because some of them are going to do a very good job. If you're going out and you're running or walking, it's going to record those really well. But if you're a cyclist, it's not going to generally do that. You need a device that's going to monitor heart rate as well and take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. So the activity you do should play a role in what you're trying to do as far as device selection.
And because cycling, you're not taking steps the way you might be if you're walking or jogging, so it doesn't count?
Yeah, so usually it's going to have a set point, and every time it feels a vertical acceleration, it'll say, okay, we've hit that, and it counts that as a step. Now, in cycling, you're not really moving up and down at all. You're in a pretty stationary position. Right. I used to do a lot of spin classes when I lived in Michigan, and I wore a pedometer, and I'd get frustrated because I did an hour of really, really hard work, and I get done and go, I got nothing for that with my pedometer. So,
and you're a competitive guy. We learned you're a very competitive guy, Nate. So, So should we incorporate this, Stella, in our daily lives, knowing that it may not count everything, and there might be some questions about overall accuracy? Should we, Stella?
I think incorporating them can be very helpful for people because, again, it gives them that baseline. It allows them to know. And again, if you're like Nate and me, and you are competitive, you might say, "Well, geez, I need to walk a little bit more today because yesterday I'm lower than yesterday." So you may likely decide that you're going to walk a little bit more. So it is helpful, even if in the beginning people only wear it a little bit for a few months and then stop wearing it because they get an idea of what they're doing.
Right.
They can be motivating. It's just that what's difficult, and I'm sure Nate will agree, is changing people's behavior for the long term is the most frustrating thing we have as researchers because we want them to change for the long term.
And it's hard to do that, right?
It's very hard to do that.
Nate, any final words before we say goodbye to you?
I think one of the most important things people can do when they're selecting these fitness trackers is realize that, like you were saying, every single day is designed to be more healthy. And so whatever we can do to increase activity levels from what they were before to something higher, that's a very beneficial thing.
Well, on that note, Nate Mekas, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. He's Assistant Professor of Applied Exercise Science at Azusa Pacific University and has been doing some research on those exercise trackers that you see people wearing. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen and Stella Volpe, chairwoman of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University, with us for the full hour. And let me see what Kim from South Philadelphia has to say. And Kim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great program.
Thank you.
I was wondering if Stella might have any advice for those of us who would like to have a conversation with our family members about their dietary choices, but want to do so in a way that doesn't make them defensive. Sort of struggling with this, talking to my dad, who's had quadruple bypass surgery in the last year, and would just love some advice for how to get him back on the road to making good choices.
You're worried about him, Kim?
I am.
Yeah.
I am.
You're a good daughter. Let me see what Stella Volpe has to say.
Kim, thanks for the call. That is always so touchy to discuss with people, even after they've had such a major event in their lives to make a change. And just getting back to what I said to Marty earlier, behavioral change is the toughest thing. And the older we are, the tougher it gets. However, I think you can, you know, slowly sit down and talk with your dad as far as bringing things up in small pieces, you know, instead of sitting down with him and talking with him about all these major things and how, you know, I think bringing up that you're worried about him is actually a very good thing, because you are his daughter, and that shows how much you love him and want him around for the long term. But perhaps, you know, step by step, you know, perhaps making small changes in his diet, or even bringing things over to his house and that are healthful, but maybe don't tell him you made big changes until after he's eaten and says, boy, that was really a great meal. So things like that, like maybe taking a little walk with him and just saying that you want to walk and talk in the park, and not making as big of a deal about some of this stuff as maybe in your head you have, but trying slowly to make these changes over time. And I promise you it will work, but you have to plant the seeds day by day, just small seeds, and I promise you he'll make some changes over time.
Well, and it sounds like him is very sensitive to this, but as you were talking, Stella, I was thinking about the kind of shaming that can go on when someone is, you know, concerned about somebody but wanting to control their behavior, and how difficult it is when someone is basically shaming you.
Exactly, and that's a great point, Marty. We don't want to do that. It's more of, I really just want you to be healthier. You know, I want my dad to be with me, and just to have, you know, giving some information that's going to be helpful and healthful, and not saying, oh, because you need to lose 20 pounds or anything like that, just to sort of make small changes in his life and help him to do that.
Kim, good luck to you. And let me see what looks like Ron from Cape May County has to say. And Ron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Just a couple of points. I'm enjoying your program.
Thank you.
I started exercising when I was 22, just for something to do after work. And when I was 24, I watched my father have a premature heart attack at age 50. And he had a stroke at age 56.
Wow.
So I really kicked up my program of training, and I haven't stopped since. So I'm 60 now, and I got to tell you, it has I've beaten the genetic odds. I haven't had either one of those situations happen to me. But I've also maintained a lean body mass. And I also think that when I look at people in gyms and I look at, you know, how they exercise, I know that machines are kind of like the exercise equipment du jour, but I'm really against that. I use free weights. I use dumbbells. I've altered my program over time, and it's worked for me. Well, I also think there's another component that maybe it was touched upon before early on in the show, was that the foods are so processed today that it requires less energy to masticate the food that it did years ago. And I think that might be one component as well, as far as weight gain is concerned. But I have an ideal body weight. So.
Well, good for you. And it sounds like you have made this part of your life's work, and that it's working, Stella.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. And so a few things you said. One, first, congratulations. You certainly beat those genetic odds because of lifestyle. And so lifestyle really makes a big difference. I also applaud the fact that you are using free weights, et cetera. I do many different sports, and including CrossFit, which is a very high-intensity workout that some people are against, but we always use either our bodies or free weights. Again, being careful if you start, because you need to learn how to do it correctly. However, that is very helpful, because you have to use the full range of motion when you're using free weights, for example. And the other point you brought up is about processed foods. People should try to shop the perimeter. The whole foods are more in the perimeter. So when you go food shopping, less time in the middle of the store, more time in the perimeter, because the more whole foods and less processed foods we eat, the far better that is for us.
Ron, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Can you be heavy and healthy?
You can. That's actually been a very big argument, a big discussion, rather, among folks in the exercise physiology and nutrition fields. But there is this quote that people say, you can be fit and fat, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, that's what people will say, and some researchers like Stephen Blair have found that, yep, you can certainly be a little overweight but still exercise and have what we call a healthy metabolic profile, meaning your blood lipids might be good, your blood pressure may be good. You know, we still know that a higher BMI, body mass index, can lead to chronic diseases. So it's not that we should say it's okay. However, if someone's exercising and doing everything right, not smoking, they're in a better shape than someone who might be thinner, smoking, and not eating well.
Let me see what Diana from Ewing has to say. Diana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was calling in regards to the exercise ball that Stella mentioned earlier. Do you recommend a certain size ball for, like, I'm 5'7", as opposed to, like, a small? I know I wouldn't use a small ball, but I just wasn't sure what size ball to get.
Diana.
Yeah, Diana.
Diana, yep. thanks for the call. You know, you want, I have like the bigger size, and I'm only 5'4". So if there is one slightly bigger, you want to be comfortable, and obviously you don't want your knees sort of up to your chest. And also, if you are using it at a desk, ensure that it's high enough that you're not reaching up to the desk or reaching too far down. So ergonomically, you want to ensure that that it's high enough for you. There are ones that come on a little stand, which I have actually in one of my offices, so I can push it under my desk. They're little rollers. And so then you can actually raise it a little bit more if you needed to, if the ball on the ground was too low for you. And again, starting with it too slowly, even if you are fit, so that you do get used to it, you know, with that core, using that core as often as you might be working at your desk.
Okay, Diana, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Does our metabolism change as we age? I mean, do things sort of slow down so that it is harder to actually lose weight as one gets older?
Our metabolism does slow down, unfortunately, starting at the age of about 25 to 30. It will slow down, I know. However, Marty, I think, too, a lot of that research was done on people who haven't really been stay fit. So even something called sarcopenia, which is muscle loss over time, they say after the age of 40, that's when we start to lose muscle. A lot of that work has been done on people who aren't exercisers. So we do need a lot more long-term research to say, how much does metabolism go down if someone is very fit? How much muscle loss do we have if we are very fit? So yes, it is. It becomes difficult. And again, postmenopausally, that's something that you know, we slow down a bit, but it doesn't mean that we can gain weight.
Well, on that note, Stella Volpe, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Chair of the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University, a nutritionist and exercise physiologist. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can carry on some of the conversations we've been having today, or leave us a comment as well. Go to our homepage. Also, check out Facebook, Twitter, archives, podcasts, satellite radio, and email. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and thanks for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us.